The American former CEO of Barclays Bank is on the hot seat in London. What a way to celebrate the 4th of July for him. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, July 4th. Happy Independence Day, everybody. Later in the podcast, we're also going to go to probably the one place in England where they actually celebrate the 4th of July along with us. That's coming up in a moment.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So out of the corner of our eyes all morning, we've been watching this American CEO, former CEO, I should say, Bob Diamond. He resigned yesterday from the spot atop Barclays Bank. He's spending his 4th of July getting grilled by a parliamentary committee in London. So the parliament is investigating whether Barclays and two other banks manipulated a key interest rate. It's this LIBOR thing we've been talking about and you've probably been hearing about quite a bit the last day or two. Over the course of the morning, the Barclays story has gotten really more and more twisted and focused on who said what to whom and when. Barclays says all this happened because one of Diamond's subordinates misunderstood a memo from his boss based on a call in which the Bank of England may or may not have suggested Barclays should report a lower LIBOR interest rate. It's very complex. At this hour, the British MPs are still tenaciously trying to wring out the truth. Here's one of them.
Okay, I just want to be clear.
Sorry.
You don't think you received an instruction. You don't think it was even a nod and a wink, even though it reads that way to almost anyone who looks at it.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard is deciphering this game of telephone between Barclays and the Bank of England, out of which someone got the idea to adjust the so-called LIBOR interest rate. He's with me now from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So we've gotten a chance now to hear from Bob Diamond from about a half hour or so. What's he saying?
Right. Well, he admits there was reprehensible behavior by some people in the bank, but so far at least, he clearly has not included himself in that assessment. He says that Barclays is in the frame now. Barclays is getting all the heat because Barclays has been the first of the 16 banks involved in the LIBOR rate-setting system to be found guilty and to be fined.
I think there has been an unfortunate series of events around Barclays being identified as the first bank in what was, you know, a report that clearly showed very, very bad behavior by groups of people.
So, Stephen, what does Diamond say about this claim that he was pressured somehow by the Bank of England to lower this interest rate?
Well, he says that he did not take the remarks by this senior Bank of England official, Paul Tucker, in a phone call as an instruction to lower the interest rate. And in a statement, Barclays has said that it was the chief operating officer who took the transcript of the phone conversation and acted on it. This is still pretty murky stuff, Jeff. I mean, we have to ask ourselves the question, why did Barclays actually reveal the details of this phone call between the Bank of England official and Bob Diamond if they didn't want to raise the notion that there had been some pressure from the Bank of England?
Right. It is getting juicy, that's for sure. What do we know of what the Bank of England itself is saying?
Well, the Bank of England is insisting that it did not in any way encourage Barclays to manipulate the interest rate, the LIBOR interest rate. Barclays has said that Paul Tucker, the deputy governor, has insisted on being called before this parliamentary committee to make this very point.
And just very quickly, Stephen, another front in the Barclays saga today, all of these class action suits. What's up with that?
Yes, a number of class action lawsuits against the banks involved in the rate-setting system, these representing U.S. municipalities, pension funds, insurance companies, and other corporations who believe that because their loans or their deposits were pegged to LIBOR, they lost out. Lawyers involved in this case say it could involve tens of billions of dollars in damages.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London, thank you very much.
Okay, Jeff.
If you're looking for some fun holiday reading material, the so-called living wills of the 9 largest U.S. banks are now available for viewing. These are supposed to prevent another too-big-to-fail scenario. They tell regulators what the banks plan to do in the event that they become insolvent. But will the wills do their job? Here's our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore.
No matter how patriotic you're feeling today, you probably don't want the government to bail out another bank. That's why Congress forced the banks to come up with a plan to pay the price for their own mistakes.
The living wills are not guaranteeing that losses will not occur, but losses will occur to those who have the greater investment in the banks, not to the taxpayer.
Mitchell Glassman is a director with Deloitte Consulting. In a previous life, he helped bail out banks, so he supports the living wills. But others are skeptical.
The drawbacks are that they aren't going to work.
Dwight Smith is a partner with Morrison & Foerster. He thinks the same way as the boxer Mike Tyson, who said, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth." In other words, in a crisis, all bets are off.
The living wills assumed that there would be other big institutions able to help out.
And that's a big assumption. In the last crisis, all the banks that came to the rescue did so only with taxpayer backing. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
So along with all the Barclays news out of London this morning, here's another interesting item from the UK. The world's most popular and probably most valuable soccer team is filing for an IPO. Here in the United States, Manchester United, based in Manchester in the UK, has filed for an initial public offering in the New York Stock Exchange. Man U is owned by an American businessman named Malcolm Glazer. He also owns the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and the club's hoping to raise $100 million through the IPO. And I suppose maybe once Americans have some of their own money in the game, they might actually start to care about professional soccer.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Later today, we're expected to get the official results from Mexico's presidential election. Preliminary results from the election this past weekend showed Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party was the winner. But the runner-up is demanding a recount. Jennifer Collins reports.
Allegations are flying in Mexico's presidential election. Runner-up Andrés Manuel López Obrador says there were so many irregularities on election day, he wants a recount. There are reports that Enrique Peña Nieto's party spent millions buying favorable coverage from the leading local TV network Televisa. And in Mexico City, electronics vendor Guillermo Díaz is one of many who says he feels robbed. He's particularly worried about the claims that Peña Nieto's party spent millions on illegal giveaways during the campaign.
A mobile phone, a bill of 500 pesos, a waiver, it's ridiculous. And lots of people take it in ignorance. So they buy them with this, literally.
The Institutional Revolutionary Party had a reputation for dirty dealings during the 70 uninterrupted years it held the presidency in Mexico. Joy Langston is a professor at Mexico City Center for Research and Teaching in Economics.
So for seven decades, it won elections through a strange combination of coercion, some repression, cheating, electoral rules, shenanigans, and good policymaking.
And now many Mexicans are hoping the emphasis will be on good policymaking this time around. In Mexico City, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
From Mexican politics to Mexican beer. Last week, you might have noted the buyout of Mexico's Grupo Modelo by Anheuser-Busch InBev. It's another example of how, in the world of beer, big breweries keep getting bigger. But just in time for your Independence Day barbecue, many smaller breweries see an opportunity in the rapid consolidation of their industry. Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
Almost 90% of all beer sold in the U.S. comes from two brewing conglomerates, Anheuser-Busch InBev and SAB Miller Coors. Industry analyst Bump Williams says that concentration has led to higher prices and a drop-off in overall beer drinking in the last few years.
I think the elimination of competition is bad. I mean, it leads to complacency and mediocrity, and then there's no innovation at all.
But one segment of the industry is innovating. Some craft brewers, like Sierra Nevada, Lagunitas, and New Belgium, are doubling their capacity. Freelance beer writer John Hall says more consumers are willing to pay a premium for flavorful ales and lagers.
It's a more educated beer public these days, so people know styles that they like, and they seek them out. And with more choice out there, I think the craft breweries have benefited greatly.
Craft brewers make up less than 8% of the beer market now, but analyst Bump Williams figures their growth is sustainable, evidenced by the number of homebrewers, like me, fermenting hops and grains in garages and basements all over the country.
There's more and more home brewing supplies being sold in the United States now than I think has ever been sold in the past. That's a real tribute to consumers wanting to experiment and try to make their own home beers.
After all, one of the country's first homebrewers was George Washington. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Talking so much about Britain today, let's talk about a British colony. Aussies are getting used to the first week under a new carbon tax. The country's biggest polluters are paying a steep $24 per ton of carbon emitted. That's more than twice the cost of carbon permits in the EU. Reporter Stuart Cohen is watching the rollout down under in Sydney. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Jeff.
So we're a few days in now with this. Has there been any immediate effect of the carbon tax?
Well, many businesses around the country are already raising prices as a result, and that's before anybody's even paid a penny of the tax. The tax itself is only targeted at the 350 or so most polluting companies, but that includes utilities, transportation, and even some local governments with big greenhouse gas-emitting landfills. Australia is actually the largest per capita carbon polluter in the world because of their heavy reliance on coal-fired power plants. A lot of smaller businesses are raising prices ahead of what they expect will be a rise in electricity costs, delivery costs, and even local water and sewer rates. But on the flip side, much of the money raised by the tax is going to the public to compensate for those higher prices. Many businesses and families are saying now that the tax is a reality, they're going to start switching to more energy-efficient technologies to save money, which is what the ultimate goal of taxing carbon pollution is all about.
What does the Australian public think of the tax, by and large?
Well, the reaction's not been good so far. A new poll just out showed that two-thirds of Australians are actually opposed to the tax. Now, a lot of people believe that that's simply because the opposition has done a much better job of selling a doom and gloom message that the tax is going to kill the country's economic growth. Many people still don't think that Australia's efforts will have much of an impact globally, as long as the world's biggest polluters, the U.S. and China, still have no plan to cut their carbon emissions.
Well, if the public is not crazy about it, how confident can we be that the carbon tax is here to stay?
Well, the government insists that once the real costs and benefits of the carbon tax start becoming clear over the next few months, a lot more of the public is going to get behind this. The ironic part is that the future of the tax is really very much in doubt. The Conservative opposition party in Parliament is promising to scrap it if they come to power in the next election, and recent polls are showing they're likely to win that in a landslide.
Stuart Cohen in Sydney. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Jeff.
And now to everybody's favorite former British colony, us. Today is our 4th of July. I probably don't need to tell you that. Not surprisingly, Independence Day is a big reason for sales of American flags. But when it comes to sales of the red, white, and blue, we're actually in the red. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
The U.S. is running a flag deficit. We exported about $660,000 worth of U.S. flags last year, but we imported more than $3.5 million worth of flags, mostly from China.
Consumers do mind, and they're very vocal about it. It'll be on Facebook so fast.
That's Mary Repke of Annan Flag Maker, the biggest flag maker in the U.S. The company's been making flags
since 1847.
Despite the rising imports, domestic sales of American-made flags still outstripe those from China. Repke says since 9/11, Americans have bought more homespun flags, and in sales are up about 10% this year. Repke says the bad economy has been good for business.
The impact of the recession makes everybody much more aware of domestically produced things, and especially the flag.
Repke says presidential elections always mean a banner year for flag sales, like the miniature stick flags that get handed out at political rallies. Those flags cost about 80 cents apiece, and Annan expects to sell more than 10 million this year, including some for export. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So the forecast around the U.S. today calls for it to be super hot and rainy in a lot of places and fire danger. Meanwhile, in the English town of Sunderland, today looks to be quite beautiful, in the mid-60s, very balmy, perfect for their 4th of July celebration. That's the home of Washington Old Hall. It's a historic estate, which might be the only place in the UK, I suspect, that throws a big party for our Independence Day. Nick Dolan is the property manager there, and Nick, happy 4th of July to you.
And to you. Greetings from across the pond.
So what is the direct connection of George Washington Hall to our first president, George Washington.
Yeah, sure. Back many centuries ago, Washington Old Hall was the original ancestral home of George Washington. There was a guy called William de Wessington who took over the estate, took over the name of Wessington, corrupted to become Washington, but he was the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of the famous George Washington, first president of the U.S.
What do you do today at George Washington Hall to celebrate?
Well, we celebrate a neat, tight, hour-long ceremony. We raise the American flag. That's always raised by an American representative. We sing your national anthem, and we celebrate the original concept of independence. So it's a lovely ceremony, quite a moving one at times, and fun too.
Well, I'm sure it is, but I'm sure you'll also admit it seems a little weird because, of course, this was not a great event, American independence, that is, in the history of your country.
Well, that is true when you go back. However, when you actually have a look at the original concept of the Declaration of Independence, I think it's that we celebrate, the concept behind setting up of a democracy. Then I think it's not so crazy.
And you try not to think too hard then about the specifics of it, which are that our country told your country to take a hike.
I think history is history, and without the American link, Washington Old Hall as a building wouldn't have been able to be saved. And so the American links are very important to us in the actual preservation of this historical bit of the northeast of England.
Well, I'm glad we can all agree to let bygones be bygones.
Absolutely.
I wish you a very happy 4th of July celebration. Thank you so much.
And to you, and best regards to all across the pond on this very special day for us.
Well, with the terrible weather and the fire danger, a number of communities are calling off their fireworks celebrations this year. And, of course, local government budgets have also been under strain lately. Dr. George Zambelli is chairman of his long-running family company, Zambelli International. It's one of the biggest fireworks contractors in the world. And thanks for coming by.
Great to talk with you, Jeff.
Local budgets are tight, that's no surprise, and don't take this the wrong way, but fireworks might be seen as kind of a less than essential function of government. So, how's business?
Well, business is great. It's booming, actually. Fireworks are Americana. Independence Day is time to celebrate our freedom. So, the use of display fireworks is still increasing, and municipalities and communities are finding innovative ways to put on their display.
So what's state of the art? What's the craziest stuff that you can do now?
Well, with fireworks, certainly firing them with a computer. Recently, we integrated flames in the People's Natural Gas Light the River Spectacular in Pittsburgh. And the most exciting feature was a system called Firewater. It's a relatively new system that shoots narrow flames between 10 and 20 feet long that actually replicated the effect of water fountains at the Bellagio Hotel in Vegas.
So that sure beats the way they did it back in the day on the Cuyahoga.
It certainly is. And we're actually incorporating computer chips in the shells to replace time fuse.
Computer chips in the fireworks shells themselves.
Right.
Incredible.
So there's some interesting things that are occurring in the industry.
Chairman George Zambelli of Zambelli International Fireworks, thank you very much.
Thank you as well, Jeff, and have a safe and sane 4th of July.
Finally, in Narrowsburg, New York, they're canceling the fireworks because of eagles. Bald eagle nests are too close to the fireworks zone, so says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So between the two symbols of American Independence Day, the eagles win this round. And meanwhile, the violent storms from this past weekend mean hundreds of thousands of people are getting ready on this July 4th to party like it's 1776 without electricity. But hopefully not without podcasts. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.